Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Today, conversations with remarkable minds focusing upon the role of NATO in the 21st century and the serious global problems of conflict it presents. My guest, Colonel Lawrence Welkerson, a retired U.S. Army colonel and the former chief of staff to General Colin Powell while he was Secretary of State. He's currently a distinguished adjunct professor of government and public policy at the College of William & Mary in Virginia. He started as an assistant to General Powell in 1989 and remained with him through his term in the Bush administration. He's been an outspoken critic of the Iraq War, the Bush and the Cheney White House, including his own preparation of what became the paper of that was read by Colin Powell in 2003 at the United Nations. He has been a very distinguished career officer in the Marines, Army, and Navy. He's a frequent commentator on radio television programs, including The Ed Show on MSNBC. He also has been featured in several important documentaries, including Why We Fight, The Israeli Lobby, and No End in Sight. In 2009, he received the Sam Adams Award for Integrity Intelligence. Nice to have you with us today.
Good to be with you.
I feel we need to begin by first identifying the reasons why the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, or NATO, was founded in 1949, and what were the conditions that contributed to NATO's founding, what was the organization's original mission and purpose, and finally, if NATO was founded largely as a defensive coalition against the Soviet Union, shouldn't NATO then have become obsolete after the collapse of the Soviet Union and the end of the Cold War?
Those are all good questions, and unfortunately, they're not questions that got any addressal with regard to the H.W. Bush administration, and particularly subsequent administrations, at the end of the Cold War. As your implication was, NATO, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, was formed, and its first commander was Dwight Eisenhower, essentially to meet the threat that the Soviets presented after they began to recede from being our ally in World War II and began to become our enemy under Joseph Stalin, of course. The formation of the alliance and the Marshall Plan and all the things that went along with our strategy to begin to combat the Soviet Union were all very dicey things at the time. They didn't pass by large margins, in other words. There was a significant element in the Congress that was opposed to continued U.S. involvement in Europe and so forth. But with iconic figures like George Marshall and Dwight Eisenhower and others, Harry Truman, Dean Acheson, his very competent Secretary of State, being for them and advocating very strongly for them, we managed to get them put into place, and NATO became, I think, one of the most successful political and military alliances in human history. It's not too much to say that NATO was the bulwark against the Soviet Empire and was a big instrument in that empire's collapse.
I appreciate the overview. Thank you. I'm confused about something, and hopefully you'll be able to share an insight with me that allows me a better perspective. On the one hand, we have seen the United States and its proxies in the NATO alliance be intimidating to Russia, and even to be intimidating for a different reason to China. And yet at the same time, during the last 10 years, China has been a major purchaser of our debt, over $1.6 trillion, and was our number one trading partner for the last 12 years. Russia, on the other hand, has been struck with a lot of sanctions, and it has spent most of its money on its own internal and domestic venues. Then I compare the amount of money the United States spends on its military-industrial complex, and the best figures I can find from multiple quality sources are not the $585 billion that we're stating as a direct defense budget, but rather is close to $1.4 trillion when you add in all of the other outsourced, independent, and contract required programs. And then I look at how much all the other major players spend, including Russia and China, in the last 10 to 12 years, and it's not even one-tenth of what we spend. And yet we hear the neocons constantly stating that we need to spend more on our military-industrial complex, that we're vulnerable to Russia, and the media is aligning the argument that somehow today Russia is an impending threat and they're going to invade, and it is, will destabilize all of Europe. And when I look at the data, I simply don't see it, and I don't see why we would be provoking Russia and China when, if we couldn't win in Afghanistan against the Taliban, how could we possibly win a war, if that's our intent, in Russia or China, in today's modern age, since both are nuclear nations? Then they don't want war. They would destroy all their infrastructure, all their gross benefits they've accumulated in the last 10 to 15 years. Could you give me a better insight on what's going on, please?
Well, you've stated categorically a rather complex situation, and I don't disagree with your summary in its whole. Let's go back to NATO for just a moment, and let's say that one of the biggest strategic errors the United States made, in my view, and in a lot of other people's views too, was to change the "we aren't going to stick our fingers in Moscow's eyes" attitude and policy, even, that H.W. Bush implemented. Regardless of the fact that, as I said, that we didn't seem to have a strategy, particularly with respect to NATO, after the Cold War ended, we did have a policy that we articulated to Mikhail Gorbachev and to his foreign minister, Edward Shevardnadze. And that policy was summed up by Jim Baker, H.W. Bush's Secretary of State, and this is almost a direct quote: "If you will agree to the reunification of Germany and its retention in the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, we will not move that organization one inch further east." Let me emphasize that, not one inch further east. So we were telling Moscow, we were telling Russia, after the end of the Soviet Empire, that we were not going to beat our chest and beat the drums and be, you know, the usual kind of victor and trump our victory over them. We were going to welcome them into the new world, welcome them with open arms, as a matter of fact. We even said you can be an observer to the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, to NATO, and eventually we'll work you into membership, full membership of NATO. This was the program. Along comes William Jefferson Clinton, and then later George W. Bush, and we just renounce that policy completely. And not only do we move NATO further east, we go to Georgia, as George W. Bush did, in Tbilisi, the capital of Georgia, and we announced that Georgia is going to be on the track for NATO membership. We announced similar things about Ukraine. Well, this is like saying to the United States that the northern states of Mexico are going to become a member of the Warsaw Pact, or that the provinces of Canada are going to become members of the Warsaw Pact. So there's no doubt in my mind why Putin reacted in Crimea, in Georgia, and now Ukraine the way he reacted, because we made big blunders with regard to expanding NATO. So that's how we got to this point where Russia has suddenly become an enemy, and we have people like Defense Secretary Ash Carter talking about a new Cold War. I think that's moronic. I think that's idiotic, but that's what he's talking about. Right now, the situation is so tense that the only real impediment to a new Cold War is the President of the United States, Barack Obama, because he is adamantly opposed to letting it go that far. I'm frightened for the prospect of Hillary Clinton being president, because I don't think she is going to have that circumspection. I don't think she's going to have that strategic grasp. I think she is going to be led by certain of the neocons in her advisory team, and she is going to put this track between the United States and Russia and Europe and Russia on full march, and we're going to be looking at a new Cold War. It's very frightening. Now, I've summed up a very complex situation quickly, but that's kind of how we got to where we are now. U.S. strategic era of the first order, followed by compounding of that error with George W. Bush pulling out of the ABM treaty, one of the greatest accomplishments of arms control, precipitously, deploying ballistic missile defense in former Warsaw Pact countries, and generally sticking his finger in Moscow's eyes, in addition to what Bill Clinton had already started. Had I been Vladimir Putin, I think I would have reacted precisely the way he's reacted. And now, as you implied, we're looking at a potential new Cold War between Russia and the United States when we need Russia. We need Russia badly for such things as solving the Syrian conflict, solving the situation in Afghanistan ultimately, solving the situation in Iraq ultimately, solving the situation, if we can, in North Korea with its nuclear weapons already there, and a number of other things, not to mention global climate change, which is an existential challenge confronting us all, and if we don't cooperate, we're all going to be gone. So, yes, this is a very complex situation made all the more complex and made dangerous by the United States.
How has their defining roles for NATO changed from NATO's original mission? And second, both Bush and Clinton make reference to NATO's open door policy. Explain this from the vantage point of American expansionism, because both France and Germany at those times raise objections to admitting former Soviet countries into NATO.
As well they should have, being realists and not pipe dreamers like we are. Just listen to what Clinton said, and before her, Bush, of course, and talking about the expansion of NATO and what's happening. The EU is falling apart. The British just voted to leave the EU. Greece is a basket case. The dominant power in the EU economically, financially, and almost any way you want to look at it in terms of success is Germany. Many people are saying, hey, the World War II wasn't won by the West. It was won by Germany. They just didn't figure it out until now. The whole situation in Europe is changing even as we speak, and NATO has nothing to do with it, with the possible exception that it's exacerbating some of its problems, the leading one of which is we're setting off Europe, such as it is, and the United States, such as it is, against Russia once again, which is a nonsense and very dangerous development. As I said, we need to cooperate. Moscow and Washington need to cooperate on so many things in the world. I don't give a darn what Putin is doing internally. I'm a realist. What I care about is that Russia is still a great power. What I care about is Russia still has a lot of nuclear weapons. What I still care about is we set out on a path to deal with Russia cooperatively and basically as colleagues in this world, and now we are back on a path of contretemps, of standing off against one another. And when I look at it and I think about it, what really made these decisions necessary? I'll tell you what made these decisions necessary. Selling ballistic missile defense, selling F-16 fighter aircraft, selling other armaments of war. We are the world's death merchant now. We lead the world by billions of dollars in arms sales. And what we wanted to do was continue to sell these arms to more and more countries. So if you want to look for a reason why Bill Clinton expanded NATO, and if you want to look for a reason why George W. Bush expanded NATO, don't look at the ideology. Yes, that was important for some. We're going to bring freedom and democracy to everybody in the world, and we're going to do it first in Europe, and we're going to do it through NATO. But the real reason underlying all that is to sell arms to all of these people, to keep the arms merchants warm, to keep their production lines going, to keep all those weapon systems flowing out to even newer and newer customers. That's the real reason.
There are several issues that we're not bringing together in our society, certainly not in the media. I'll share three of them with you. When the president received the Nobel Peace Prize, many of us had hoped that he would continue what was started under Kennedy and others, and that was start taking down and destroying the nuclear weapons and do it with treaties like with Russia, and Russia, in fact, was indeed doing that. But instead, he's turned around and as of now has pledged $1 trillion to $1.5 trillion in new spending for a whole new generation of nuclear arms. He has also then position that we need these. Along comes Hillary Clinton, who now says that two things. She has no problem attacking Iran if Iran, she feels, poses a threat to not just the United States, but our allies, meaning Saudi Arabia or Israel primarily, and that she would do this. Then she says something even more concerning, that she has no problem going up against Russia. Now, she said this before the Council on Foreign Relations, but she's also said something similar to the Free Enterprise Institute and some other very hawkish organizations, think tanks, with all of these highly talented, best and brightest group of technocrats running them that weave into industry and the Defense Department, other agencies in State Department, then go back into these industries and these think tanks. So I'm hearing her say, Barack Obama is funding and we are building these nuclear weapons, and I don't have a problem using them. And then that leads me to this hypothesis. Is it possible that if Hillary Clinton becomes president, that would be a green light for Netanyahu and his Likud party to do a preemptive attack against Iran? Now, there's one caveat that no one is talking about, nowhere in the media, and that is that for several years, the United States, working in cooperation with Israel and the Mossad, especially our National Security Agency and the Defense Department, created the most sophisticated type of virus ever, created in computer research. It would go into, through malware, it would go into their system, and it would begin to not send messages back, but adversely affect their nuclear research materials and start to cause some of the machine that they have to blow up. And yet at the same time, they wouldn't be able to detect it. Their monitors would not be able to discover this, and there was no fingerprint bringing it back to us. Unfortunately, when that happened, and also there were a number of top nuclear scientists in Iran who were assassinated, we thought that, okay, great plan. No one admitted it. But then two independent scientists who are considered the tops in the United States is determining who's attacking you, what systems are they using, how did they do it, and how you can protect yourself. After months of research, they actually find that there's only two plausible explanations. Either the United States or Israel, the only countries capable with the technology and the mind power to create this system, who would also have the motivation, the rationale for doing it. No one admits it, but that's what they found. In the process of finding this, Iran then realized that many of its piece of equipment were blowing up because of this. So they got a whole group of geeks on their end to start trying to find this malware and to disinfect their systems. And Russia jumped in and China jumped in, and they're thinking, wow, this is real serious cyber warfare. Then out comes this, that Israel, on its own, unilaterally, created a separate system, a separate malware that would completely turn off all electricity in Iran. Therefore, there would be no telephones, no satellite feeds. There would be no, if they were attacked, there would be no one from one position being able to communicate with another position. All of their appliances, computers, everything will go down. Now, you're already talking about one of the most hot countries in the world. Could you imagine what would be happening to the innocent civilians if that were to occur? And you got 82 million people living in a country three times the size of Iraq, and they're not all involved in a theocracy. Many are very progressive by our standards. And we would be alienating everyone in the country, putting thousands of people, if not hundreds of thousands, their lives at risk. But also in this malware, you couldn't reboot your system. So at the very least, many of their systems would be out for weeks and some for months. If you have a country without any electricity for weeks or months, you're going to have an enormous impact on that country. Also goes against Geneva Convention of adversely affecting infrastructure that serves civilians, not military. So then my question is, why would Israel do this? Unless, and this is a hypothesis only, they intended to do a preemptive strike against Iran, knowing they couldn't do that easily and without casualties. But if they turned off all their electricity, crashed all their computers, then they virtually could destroy everything in the country they chose to destroy, and the United States and Hillary Clinton would be there, as she's repeatedly says, to back them up. And what then would that cause in the rest of the world? And cyber warfare then could be an effect of this. And also, Russia and China immediately jumped in, realizing that this could also impact them. And thousands of scientists were brought in Russia and China to start building their cybersecurity systems and possibly their offensive systems, so that now it may be possible. And again, this is purely a hypothesis of mine, that if we allowed this to occur, China, Russia, Iran, or any of these combinations could then inflict a cyber warfare on the United States. The difference is, if they turned off our electricity, you're looking at not just the inconvenience of electricity being gone, but you're also looking at 98 nuclear facilities still operational, and they only have 1 week to 4 weeks worth of backup fuel. That's all that's required. That means that before the electricity could be turned on, you may have meltdowns and Fukushima-style reactor explosions. And I'm thinking, of course, what could happen, not that it would, but then it's all based upon this super hawkish notion that nuclear is the way we're going. Your thoughts, please.
You've covered a lot of ground. Let me make three points that are related. One is Iran and Hillary Clinton. You're absolutely correct. She scares me because she's much more bellicose with regard to Iran, much more apt to support Israel because they're big supporters of her, and much more apt to get us in a mess, another mess, if we aren't in enough already, in Western Asia, in the Middle East, this one war with Iran. My second point would be the nuclear program. I agree with you entirely that we do not need to be wasting these trillions of dollars over the next 30 years to do the things that we've said we're going to do to our nuclear program. In the military, we studied the situation with regard to nuclear weapons many, many times. Our analysis showed that we could probably get by, that is to say, be very secure, with anywhere from 300 to 400 warheads, and then to work from that total as much as is possible. I'm not sure it is possible, but to work towards zero nuclear weapons on the face of the earth. Once the genie's out of the bottle, it's very hard to get it back in. So I'm leery of the fact that we'd be able to get there, but we ought to be working on it. Indeed, as signatories to the Non-Proliferation Treaty, we are supposed to be working on it by international treaty law. Nuclear weapons are not where we should be going. That's the bottom line. And we definitely shouldn't be spending so much money. But you've got all these congressmen and all these state facilities, all these different places around the country, from those who produce tritium to those who make the other components of the weapons, who are lobbying the Congress every day to spend this money and to keep their industry alive. So again, it's these contractors, it's this defense mechanism, this merchant of death mechanism that keeps these things going and keeps them alive. It's not strategy. It's not national security. It's people, it's jobs, it's money, and so forth. The third thing is what you mentioned that is extremely dangerous, and that is what we're doing with regard to what we're calling cyber warfare. Those science fiction fans out there who go back as far as I do probably remember a book in the 70s called Neuromancer. That's where we're headed. We're headed where bombers don't fly, drones don't fly, regardless of their high-tech capability today. None of this stuff. Ships don't sail. Armies don't march. We just destroy each other via networks, via systems of systems and the networks that connect them. That's where we're headed. And we're headed there without any international law analysis, without any analysis of what should be put in place in terms of protocols and standards, if we're going to have this kind of economic warfare against one another. And it probably is going to happen. Every other form of warfare in the history of humanity has happened in one way or another. This stuff is very deadly. What you've mentioned is just the tip of the iceberg. If we, China, Russia, and several other countries in the world decided to go at one another with real economic warfare, financial warfare, real fundamental warfare aspects of the cyber war we were conducting against one another, we could bring our societies to its knees. And we'd all be sitting around. We wouldn't have any mushroom clouds to speak of. We wouldn't have any blowdown, as happened at Hiroshima and Nagasaki and at the end of World War II, when we were the only country in the history of the world that ever used nuclear weapons. But we would have the kind of devastation that you just implied, where you have no power, you have no technology at all that's working, you are broken. And there is no more vulnerable country in the world, no more networked country, no more technologically sophisticated country, no more country with the key nodes necessary to bring it to its knees were someone to strike those key nodes than the United States. So in many respects, we're digging our own grave by walking into this area of warfare without any thought, without any consultation, without any building of protocols and standards and law before we go into it. I mean, we're going to go into it. It's already there. We're already doing it to a certain extent, as you implied. We need to talk about it, and we need to have some protocols and rules and laws just like we do for every other form of warfare. We're not doing that. We're just going at it helter-skelter, and we're going to pay for it.
Thank you. I appreciate that insight. I'm very concerned about what is happening in Turkey, because it looked as if Turkey and very much his corrupt president and the family and many of his agencies would continue not to be challenged at all publicly by any of the major media for being a sanctuary for the terrorist activities who get training there, get arms there, then go into Syria, stealing oil and then selling it, both Iraq oil and Syrian oil, and then posturing towards being, you know, protected by NATO and also trying to get into the European Union. And then along comes this coup, and Americans don't know anything about Turkey or the coup. And then we find out that a person that we have been supporting, who has been working with us in the CIA for decades, had an organization that had over $50 billion, had been infiltrating and taking control of almost all the major institutions, including the military and the judicial and the media. And they were going to have a coup. And it was only Russia at the last moment that found out about this, contacted the president of Syria's, contacted the president of Turkey's military attaché, warned he must leave immediately. He left with only, I believe it was 2.5 hours before the helicopters arrived, and they were going to take him out, him and his family. And then a whole new government was going to be declared. They missed that opportunity because they weren't ready for their coup, and then the people went to the streets once he escaped and only had one media to go to, but all these people came out in his support. Now, that's changed things, because now, today, he just signed an agreement with Russia to start re-cooperating with Russia. So Russia is no longer his enemy. Russia is now his friend, and also he's agreed no longer to support any activity that would harm Assad's regime in Syria. Now, that's a game changer in many respects for Hillary Clinton if she becomes president, because now it's, as Turkey was so much an important geopolitical area. Could you give us your perspective on Turkey, the fact that all of this is going to come out? They have too many documents. They've got too many people now, according to what I've read from reliable sources, who were part of the coup, who, to save their lives, are going to share everything they can. And we're going to be embarrassed, because it's not often the United States is caught sponsoring a coup that would take over an entire country as important as Turkey. Your thoughts, please.
This is an extremely complicated situation, easily, perhaps more importantly, serious than the civil war in Syria itself. Here you have a NATO ally of some time and standing with arguably the largest, most powerful army in NATO, certainly second only to our own, and maybe even in terms of ground-holding power, superior to our own, And it is suddenly embarked on a path no one knows the objective of. And it's led by Tayyip Erdogan, who has just put down this coup, which did nothing but strengthen his hold over the Turkish people, as we've seen demonstrated by the people in the streets and by the opposition they put up to the coup. Turkey has a history, as you probably know, of the military taking over periodically ever since Kemal Atatürk founded the modern Turkish state. And they just have repudiated that tradition. They've said, no more, we're not going to do it again. And they've done it ostensibly in the name of democracy. But it's an odd type of democracy because Erdogan has become a tyrant. He has taken over almost all the sinews of power in the government. One might even think that he was in favor of this coup. Now, that's not to say that he knew about it beforehand, but I think if he were looking back on it retrospectively, he's got to pat his own back and say, boy, this was terrific, because what it did was, at a time when his political power was beginning to be somewhat questionable, even amongst the populace in Turkey, it solidified his political power. It gave it a kick. It gave it a bump you wouldn't believe. He is now the leader of Turkey, and he is the leader of Turkey for the foreseeable future, regardless of his increasingly totalitarian nature. There's nothing democratic about it, not really. His rapprochement with Russia was to be expected, because that's a finger in our eye, and that's what he's trying to do now. And he's also had a rapprochement with Netanyahu in Tel Aviv. You didn't mention that. That's a very interesting note, too, that Netanyahu would stick his finger further in our eye by effecting a rapprochement with Erdogan. So it's a very complicated situation. Turkey has got a choice now. It has pretty much spurned the European Union, turned its shoulder to it. Don't blame it, really, because the European Union was very dilatory in accepting Turkey into it. And it has pretty much said to NATO, I'm not sure I even want to be a member of you anymore. So where is Turkey going? Is it going into a de facto alliance with Moscow? Is it going into neutrality? Is it going into being a more and more Islamic-type state rather than the secular state that Kemal Atatürk tried to create? After all, one of Erdogan's appeals to this majority of Turks who are with him now has been Islamic and Islam. And it's been less than what I would call the usual type of Islam that we associate with Turkey, the moderate type of Islam, the secular type of Islam, if you will, if that's not a contradiction of terms. So this is a very complicated situation, and it is another indicator that the North Atlantic Treaty Organization is an anachronism, even a farce, waiting to fall apart.
Let us follow up what you just said, and that is that recently, the leaders of NATO met in Poland, and the plans that emerged suggest NATO and the United States intend to instigate, as you said earlier, a new Cold War with Russia. In addition, NATO recently conducted military exercises in Poland and the Baltics, close to Russia's borders. And also, during the Democratic Convention, there was a lot of saber-waving against Russia and demonizing Vladimir Putin. However, all indications show that the United States is the aggressor, not Russia. The U.S. supported coup in the Ukraine is one example. So could you share with us your observations and analysis for why Russia is being perceived as such a dangerous threat to the United States and our allies and our global interests?
I think there are two sides of the answer to that question. One is ideological. You have people like Samantha Power and Susan Rice, and I have to say Hillary Clinton and others in the Democratic Party. You have some in the Republican Party, and you have lots of neoconservatives who keep a foot in both parties just so they'll have power, who believe that freedom and democracy, Jeffersonian style, is sweeping the globe, and that where it doesn't sweep clean, it needs American military power to be its broom. And they think that's what began with the end of the Cold War, and that no one, including Putin, including anyone in the world, was going to object to that. And anyone who did, we were going to knock down with that military broom. That's one side of it, the ideological side, very dangerous side, because these people actually believe this bull. The other side is what I call the demented realpolitik side. And that's the side that we referred to earlier. That's the side that sees Raytheon, Lockheed, and all these defense contractors as political puppets to be bled of all their money and profits that's possible in order to keep us in political power. So you have congressmen, and you have people who run for the presidency who are very indebted to these people for the money and influence that they can give them in order to stay in political power. That's the hardcore steel magnolia, if you will, side of this argument. So you've got the ideological side that thinks it ought to be spreading democracy and freedom all across the globe, regardless of people's objections thereto, and using the military if they object too strenuously. And then you've got the side that's working on political power, on money, and everything else that this underside of America is constantly working on, building up the fortunes of the less than 1% and so forth. You got them working the real side of the street. So you got the ideology, you got the realist side of it, and it's all pushing to try and get another Cold War going with the Russians. China's not enough for them. You know, we used to have an old theory in international relations, and I wish we'd bring it back. It's called conservation of enemies. That's its short title. And what it means is that no power should have more enemies than it can handle at any one time. Well, the United States has not been conversant with that principle of international relations for 3+ decades. We seem to think that we can make the entire world our enemy, bring out our wonderful military, and pound it from time to time and keep going. That is utterly absurd, and it's going to get us into big trouble.
That said, popular polls indicate the United States is overly aligned militarily with Israel and Saudi Arabia. And I find this certainly true of Clinton and the GOP's foreign policy and their close ties to AIPAC and Netanyahu's government. In your estimation, how has our relationship with Israel been a contributing factor for the Middle East's conflicts, and how we're currently enmeshed in and how it's affecting America's standing with other nations, including our allies, who are not in as much agreement with Israel and its apartheid position on the Palestinians?
Israel is an enormous component of the reason much of the world looks askance at the United States. And it's not just our bias. It's the fact that we go beyond the bias and actually act as Israel's lawyer in contretemps after contretemps. It's also the fact, as one of the Israeli intelligence officials pointed out just yesterday, that the relationship keeps the chaos in the Middle East going. The Israeli intelligence official essentially said that we want the civil war to continue, the civil war in Syria. We don't want it to stop. We don't want ISIS to be defeated, because as long as the civil war is going on, they can't concentrate on us. So as long as the region is in chaos, as long as Jordan is impacted with thousands, millions of refugees, Lebanon is impacted, Hezbollah is having to wage war inside Syria alongside its benefactor, Iran. As long as all this, Saudi Arabia is in Yemen, as long as all of this is going on, Israel is safe. That's the way some, including Netanyahu, in Tel Aviv see it. That's the way some of the neoconservatives and their allies in this country see it, too. What I'm mystified by is they don't look beyond the short term into the medium and the long term. This is extremely dangerous for Israel's security. No matter the chaos, no matter the fact that Israel's enemies are fighting amongst themselves right now, because there's 400 plus million of them, and there's only 6 or 7 million of the Israelis and the Palestinians who are members of the Israeli state. And by the way, they're probably not going to fight on the side of those 5 million Israelis when the chips are down. So here we're looking at 400 million people who are in chaos right now. But sooner or later, we'll get their act together, and I wonder what Israel thinks is going to happen then. Is Israel going to nuke them all? I think that's probably what some of the people in Israel who are more absurd than others think, that their nuclear stockpile will protect them regardless of what happens. I got news for them. they're outnumbered colossally. And if the United States ever decides that Israel is no longer a strategic asset, but is a strategic liability, which it has been since the end of the Cold War, if we ever figure that out and Israel doesn't have its big sugar daddy, Israel is toast. It's gone. It's finished. So this is one of the imponderables for me. I have these conversations with colleagues in and out of the government, and I ask them, do you really think the chaos in Syria right now, the chaos in Iraq, the chaos in the region in general, is beneficial to Israel? Well, yes, of course it is, because the enemies are fighting amongst themselves. They can't concentrate on Israel. Well, what do you think they're going to do when they quit fighting? What do you think they're going to do when they turn around and realize that they're not their own enemy so much as Israel is their enemy? What do you think is going to happen then? And what do you think is going to happen when the United States wakes up? It will someday, and begins to realize that Israel is more a liability than it is an asset. This is a situation that can't continue. Israel will be an apartheid state. It already is an apartheid state on the West Bank and in Jerusalem. It will be an apartheid state entirely within 20 years. There will be a one-state solution, and that state will be apartheid. The international community will increasingly condemn it. The United States will back away from it, and then there won't be any Israel. I'll be bold and say in 25 years, if Israel doesn't change its course, there will be no Israel, period. This is an extremely dangerous situation for both Israel and the United States and the region. I mean, we have killed hundreds of thousands of people in that region already. Don't we need to stop soon and start fixing the problems and repairing the damage?
How would you go about advising Netanyahu if anyone in his position, not him specifically, were to say, all right, we need a new direction? After all, recently, a group of the leading heads, former heads of the Mossad, of the Defense Department, and other major respected people within the military came together and they said in Haaretz magazine newspaper that your positions are damaging our future. Exactly what you said, they said. And yet no one in the American media picked up on that story. It was there. They
You're
chose
right.
not to show that there were dissenters in Israel who had been in positions of power, the highest positions of power, in each of those government agencies. And they're saying, stop it, or you're killing the next generation.
You're absolutely right.
So what would you advise?
I read Haaretz, I read the Jerusalem Post, I read some of the other things, and I had people from Israel, from Mossad, from the IDF, from Likud, from Kadima, from smaller parties, others in the Israeli civilian world tell me this is what's happening, and we don't know what to do about it, because there simply is no way to break the coalition that Netanyahu has put together. One of the reasons these security people in particular, the former generals who came out and said some of these things, did what they did was political. There's no question about that, because they want to form a party and run against Netanyahu. But you'll see me on the sideline clapping for that, because there needs to be a formidable political opposition in Israel that has the promise to kick him out of office. He's the longest-serving prime minister in Israel's history. He is extremely dangerous for Israel's future. He is becoming almost tantamount to being Israel's future and being short-lived in that regard. He needs to go. But so far, they've not been able to put together the kind of coalition to beat him at the polls. I think maybe what you're seeing in these security people and others coming out and saying these things is the beginning of a political opposition that might solidify and get him out of office. I hope that's the case anyway. Because if we don't see a new leader in Israel who's interested in doing something fast, something concrete and solid to more or less repair the situation between Israel and its own non-Jewish citizens, that's the first problem. And then repairing relations between the state of Israel and the Palestinians and the other Arabs in the region, then Israel is doomed.
Unfortunately, you are correct, and the media refuses to hear that argument, and they will not talk about it.
I've completely given up on
pro-Israel.
Yeah, I've given up on the corporately owned mainstream media in this country. They just do nothing but parrot the standard message.
Is there any evidence that our allies in Asia, such as Japan and the Philippines, are being influenced by NATO due to our growing tensions with China?
There's a different situation altogether, although there's some similarities. I think what we're seeing building in Afghanistan now, for example, and the media has missed this completely, and in the South China Sea, is the United States effort, belated, but nonetheless a fairly concrete effort now, to, on the one hand, in Afghanistan, block the One Belt, One Road adventure by China to try and link itself up industrially, productively, and so forth with Europe and elsewhere over land. And what you're seeing in the South China Sea is a similar attempt to block the maritime road, the so-called Maritime Silk Road and the Land Silk Road. These are the two, now with $2 trillion of investment against them, these are the two attempts by the Chinese, not to militarily. No way is this a military effort, but to financially and economically defeat the West, and that is to say become the number one economic power in the world without a rival anywhere near. This is what China is trying to do, and what you're seeing in Afghanistan is a lingering American presence, and I'll predict right now, you'll hear it right here, that we will not be out of Afghanistan for half a century. It'll be the new Germany in that regard. Because what we're doing in Afghanistan now is positioning ourselves astride this Chinese road into Europe and putting ourselves in a place where militarily we can influence it. And what we're doing in the South China Sea, in addition to exercising freedom of navigation rights, which is a good thing to be doing, we are also beginning to try to fix ourselves in a position where we can block the beginning of the Maritime Silk Road. So this is all about countering China and countering them with, to a certain degree, military force when they're trying to do what they're trying to do simply with economic and financial power. That's what you're looking at now with regard to China, and that, in many respects, is a much bigger policy issue, strategic issue, geopolitical issue than Russia or anything else. The only thing that dwarfs that relationship, the U.S.-China relationship in terms of strategic importance, is the existential threat presented to the whole human race by climate change, which we're simply not doing that much about right now, and it worries the devil out of me. But if you want to look up close and personal and see a threat, look at China.
I was speaking with a person that is a professor in China and meets with members of the government and gives them some advice on economic policy. And he said this to me. He said, in the United States, we are taking a very limited view of the patience that China exercises when it looks at implementing a program. He said, let me give you an example. For the last 60 years, the dollar has dominated the international currency exchanges because people always felt that it was safe, that as long as you got a T-bill, a treasury bill from us, you were buying our debt, but you could always get it redeemed because the United States will never go bankrupt, where other countries could or default on them. And right now, he said, there is so much instability in the euro and they've lost so much of its power that they're flooding their currencies into the dollar. However, what do we actually have backing the dollar? Well, we have just our good faith. All right, we have nothing solid. Now, do the math. We consider Greece a basket case at 216% debt to gross domestic product. We consider France and Italy to be virtually bankrupt at 243 and 267% debt to gross domestic product. They'll never be able to pay it off. Ireland's around 125%. But the United States, corporate debt, $26 trillion. State debts, $5 trillion. Mortgage debt, $16 trillion. Student debt, $1.3 trillion. Car debt, $800 billion. Credit card debt, $1 trillion. And then you have the Medicare, Medicaid, unsecured for the future, another $60 trillion. So we have close to 1,000% debt to gross domestic product. We have about 18.6% gross domestic product, and that's going to be a drop in the bucket. We will never be able to pay the interest on our debt, let alone the debt. So we are the debtor nation, and yet we're holding ourselves up as the safe haven of financial stability. All the while, China's looking at it, and it's been mining or buying about 900 metric tons of gold per year for a lot of years. It has, along with Russia, right behind it. Russia has one of the largest gold mines in the world, but they've been buying gold. Now they are the third currency in the world, the yuan, and they're saying, okay, we're devaluing our currency, which makes it more valuable to you to do business with us, cheaper to do business with them, but we also have gold to back it up. And so now with Russia and China moving towards backstopping their trades and their currencies with gold, and the United States not having any gold, we've been off the gold standard and silver standard for a long time, will the day come, do you believe, when the long-term idea of China's economic positioning and economic influence is dictated by our debt, which is increasing, and their economy slowing down, yes, but more stable as far as controlling the investment dollar?
I think you've hit on outside the existential challenge that climate change presents. And by the way, we'll probably be with us in the next 10 to 15 years in a way that no one will be able to deny, not even Charles and David Koch or ExxonMobil. I think you've hit upon the number one challenge confronting the United States. We are, in many respects, bankrupt. At the same time, and this is what makes it so painful to observe, at the same time, we are possessed still of a continent that probably has better resources, whether you're talking about rivers crisscrossing its breadth, or you're talking about arable land, or you're talking about water that's left, or you're talking about just the natural resources we have, you're probably talking about a country that is still advantageous beyond anyone's wildest dreams when compared to other countries in the world, particularly countries in sub-Saharan Africa, even countries in Western Asia and so forth, where desertification alone is beginning to eat them alive, and sea rise, at least on their peripheries, is going to destroy them. Bangladesh, for example, one-third of it's going to disappear in the next 30, 40 years because of sea rise. We're not going to have that much problem, but we're going to have a lot of problem, portions of Miami, portions of the eastern seaboard, and so forth. But when you look at what we are doing in order to correct the problems that you just identified and how we're magnifying those problems rather than correcting them, about how we're exacerbating them rather than taking action to do something about them, you have to sit down, even if you're an optimist, and you have to say that in 25 or 30 years, maybe less than that, the dollar will no longer be the reserve currency, no longer be the transactional currency in the world. Probably the renminbi or a combination of currencies will be, the yuan. Or we'll have gone to something else, some kind of electric blip or whatever, to represent value instead of paper money or coinage. And we won't be the predominant power with regard to that mechanism or that technology. Instead, we will have to do what the rest of the world has had to do since World War II in particular, and that is deal with the fact that inflation can go to 100, 150, 200, 300, 1,000% when we badly manage our economy, because we won't be able to just print money as we've been doing. We have printed so much money that we have outstripped the capacity of anyone in the economic world, if he admits it or she admits it to himself truthfully, to contemplate what the circumstances are and what the consequences might be. We have just printed money, and we can do that only because of what you said, because we have the world's currency, the one that everyone has faith in and flees to when the crisis comes. That's short life now. It's not going to happen for that much longer. The world is moving to balance our power. The world is moving financially to do things without us. The Asia Development Bank was the latest example of that in a macro sense. Stupid us not joining it. We should have joined it immediately, if for no other reason than to try to have at least some influence over it. But we didn't. So what you've just pointed out, short of this existential challenge coming from climate change. When I say existential, I just want your listeners to know that in 2100, which isn't that far away, we may not be here anymore. That's how serious climate change is. Other than that, what you just described, what you just mentioned, what I just briefly talked about is probably the number one challenge we're confronting right now.
We will have to continue this. I thank you very much. We're out of time, Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson, for being with us today on the Progressive Commentary Hour. I'm Gary Knoll. Thank you all for listening. Have a good day.